From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Spotify makes a big move in the podcasting world. What will it mean for independent podcast producers? Then Nadine Lubicki, the director of Oscar foreign film nominee Capernaum, cast non-professional actors to play the homeless children on the streets of Beirut.
Everyone is almost living, portraying their own story in life, their own struggle in life. So it's not really a documentary, but there's a documentary part to it.
And we'll hear an excerpt from musician B. Beeman's new album/podcast, Peace of Mind. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. As we have told you a lot of times, The Frame is both a radio show and a podcast. And as we've also told you a lot of times, you can find The Frame on your favorite podcast providers. And that includes the music streaming service Spotify, which just took a much deeper dive into podcasting. Spotify has bought the podcast producer Gimlet for a reported $200 million. Gimlet is behind some very popular podcasts, including Reply All, Startup, and Homecoming, which has just been turned into a TV series. Spotify also bought Anchor. It's a podcast creation and distribution platform. Obviously, Spotify, which last year became a public company, is known for its music. So is it changing its strategy or just expanding its offerings in an attempt to make some money? To get at some of the answers, we called up Sherry Hu. She's a freelance music and tech journalist who writes about such things for Billboard and Forbes. And when she joined me, I started by asking about Spotify's current business.
They're the leader in the music subscription market in terms of paid users. Yet they, in addition to all of their competitors, namely Apple Music, Amazon Music, YouTube Music as well, they can't turn a profit, in part because they had licensing deals with the three major labels, namely Universal, Warner, and Sony, that required Spotify to give the majority of the revenue away, essentially, to the major labels and to other rights holders, independent as well. And so from Spotify's perspective, especially now as a publicly traded company, almost a year now, they're thinking, how do we actually get a return on what we're doing? And podcast is one really good possibility from Spotify's perspective, because unlike music, for podcasting, you don't have to pay a royalty to a rights holder every time someone streams a podcast. The business model is very different.
Is part of the idea maybe that Spotify could be for the ears what Netflix is for the eyes, that they're going to curate a lot of content that you can listen to? It might be music, could be podcasting, and they're going to become the destination for people who are interested in that, just like Netflix is a destination for people who want to watch films and TV series.
I definitely think that is the case. And it's so interesting because this is what Spotify, I think, wanted to do with music, but couldn't really afford to do. Or early on, a lot of investors were suggesting that Spotify become its own record label and sign its own artists directly and own all of that content so that it didn't have to, you know, pay out money to third-party rights holders. But Spotify is in such a kind of tense relationship with the major labels where they both really need each other. And so it couldn't really disrupt the model that quickly. Whereas with podcasting, it's so fascinating that Spotify acquired both Gimlet and Anchor at the same time. So with Gimlet, Spotify is definitely taking on the role of a company like Netflix in promoting and producing its original content on its own platform, in addition to licensing outside content. But at the same time, it's even more powerful to me, because imagine if Netflix acquired not just HBO, but also iMovie or Final Cut Pro or another really powerful video editing tool. That's essentially what Spotify has done in buying out Anchor, which is powering as much as 40% of new podcasts on the market right now. And so owning every step of the podcast creation and distribution process, I think it's even more powerful than Netflix if we're looking at the podcast space specifically.
Is there a potential that the thousands of people who are out there creating independent podcasts, now might have a harder time getting their podcasts distributed and listened to, and that there's a consolidation, as you mentioned, not only in podcast producing, but in also the way that podcasts are made and distributed.
I think that's definitely a possibility. And if you look at reactions, especially from independent podcasters, that's the very first thing that came up. And for sure, I think now that it owns Gimlet, it's going to promote Gimlet podcast the most on its homepage above any third-party podcast. And this is such an interesting parallel to a problem you see in music, where Spotify, when it was first coming up, was framed as this really big democratizing force for music. Anyone could upload their music and get discovered. But then you realize that, at least as the homepage is concerned, it's still the major labels, it's still the biggest stars that are getting the most streams. If anything, it's exacerbating the power that the incumbent companies already had. And I think we still have to wait and see what happens, but I think it's very likely, just in terms of seeing how many streams one podcast versus another gets, that there can be this widening inequality between the properties that Spotify owns and everything else.
According to one report, there was an internal valuation of Gimlet that put its value at about $70 million. Spotify is paying reportedly around $200 million. What does that valuation suggest to you, not only about how aggressive Spotify is about adding podcasting, but people's valuations of podcasts going forward?
That's such an interesting difference, right? And Spotify arguably overvaluing something like Gimlet, but thinking from Spotify's perspective, even before it went into podcasts, a lot of their executives were saying that they wanted to compete and essentially steal listeners from terrestrial radio, which is a really interesting positioning. And I think it's why they're putting such a high valuation on people's ears rather than people's eyes, as Daniel Ek said in his note, because Spotify has grown into the leading music streaming platform, and yet there have been lots of studies showing that they haven't really taken away listeners from terrestrial radio. So if you're thinking from Spotify's perspective, if you think about a typical radio show or radio segment, it's a mix of music and commentary. And if you think about Spotify's algorithmic prowess in recommending and curating music, if you can combine music and podcasts in a format that is appealing enough such that it can compete with terrestrial radio and have a similar feel similarly personal, I think that is truly revolutionary if Spotify can pull that off. And I think that's why they're paying a lot up front right now for this content, so that they can start building out that product on the back end.
I should add that Daniel Ek is the CEO of Spotify. Sherry Hu is a freelance music and tech journalist. Her coverage of Spotify can be found on Billboard. She also writes for Forbes. Sherry, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Frame, we talk with director Nadine Lubecki. She directed the foreign language Oscar nominee, Capernaum.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless, and AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement, and now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Like a lot of people, I don't often see films from Lebanon, but there's a movie from the tiny Western Asian country in theaters right now that I consider required viewing. Capernaum is co-written and directed by Nadine Lubecki. When it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival last year, it got a 15-minute standing ovation. It also now has an Academy Award nomination for Best Foreign Language Film. Capernaum follows the story of a 12-year-old boy named Zane. He sues his parents to stop them from having more children that they can't care for. And when his barely adolescent sister is essentially sold to an older man, Zane runs away and must survive on the streets. Nadine Lubicki spent years doing research into the lives of poor children, many of them refugees, living on the streets and in the slums of Beirut. And she cast non-professional actors, many whose own lives mirror the story, in Capernaum. She says it all started one night when she saw a young boy trying to sleep on a Beirut sidewalk.
I was thinking, if I was in the head of this child, what would he say to me? And so I don't know. I usually don't do this. I am not somebody who draws, or I don't have this kind of reflex. But I just drew the face of a child who is, you know, shouting, like he has his mouth wide open and he's shouting at adults. And it slowly, with time, it became, you know, this child who was going to sue his parents for giving him life. So this, now I understand how this drawing slowly became that story.
When you think about how you're going to react to that, there are many different ways a filmmaker could react. One is to make a documentary, and one is to make a narrative film. So when you're thinking in your own mind about the advantages of a narrative film, what was the conversation you had with yourself, and how does a fictional story illuminate a truth that maybe a nonfiction film can't?
It started with a drawing and wanting to know more, you know, wanting to know how, what happens exactly in this child's mind. How does he look at us, this society that is neglecting him, mistreating him, abusing him? And so I started research. You know, it was a very, very long research. It took like 4 years. And the actual script writing was happening in parallel of this research. I went to a lot of prisons for minors, detention centers for minors, you know, courts, because I also wanted to understand how does the justice system work? How does it react to those kids when those kids or find themselves in front of justice because of, you know, because they need protection or because, you know, they committed a crime or what. And I spoke to a lot of kids. Most of the time those kids would tell me, I would ask one question every time at the end of the conversation. Are you happy to be alive? And most of the times, unfortunately, the answer was no. I'm not happy to be alive. I wish I was dead. Some kids would say, I wish I was dead. They just are very angry. They used to tell me, why am I here? Why am I given life? Why do they give me life if they're not gonna love me? If they're not gonna feed me when I'm hungry? If I'm gonna be tortured? If I'm gonna be abused, raped, beaten up every day? If I'm gonna, you know, never hear a nice word? And most of those kids even have a very harsh way of describing themselves. You know, they tell you, I'm an insect, I'm a parasite, I'm nothing, I'm trash. They don't even know when they are born. Most of them, 99% of those kids, when you ask them, so how old are you? He'd say, you know, I think I'm 10, I think I'm something like that. They never know their exact age. So you don't know your exact age, you don't know when you are born, what is your date of birth? So they've never, those kids never celebrated their birthday. There was never anyone that you know, blew a candle for them or that told them, you are important to me, I'm celebrating your birthday. I wanted to translate that anger. So at one point, of course, I was always not asking myself, but yes, which form should this film take? And it was always a question. But it ended up having the form it has now. And it's a sort of, you know, semi-documentary in the sense that those kids are really, and everyone in the film, none of the people in the film are actors. Everyone is almost living, portraying their own story in life, their own struggle in life. So it's not really a documentary, but there's a documentary part to it.
We're talking with Nadine Lubicki about her new film, Capernaum. When you cast not only non-professional actors, but children and some adults who are living the story that you are dramatizing, in some ways, they're probably going to reveal assumptions that you have about their lives that are incorrect. So in terms of your own education as a filmmaker, what were they telling you that challenged the way that you had seen them before and the stories and lives that you thought they had experienced?
I was very aware of that. I was aware that I didn't live this life. So eventually, maybe I have misconceptions. Maybe there are things that I haven't been, you know, I've had a normal childhood. I've never been hungry. I've never been deprived from my basic rights. I've never been deprived of school. I've never, you know, so for me, it was important that I didn't feel that I was sort of fantasizing this story. And you sometimes, unfortunately, it's only human that you judge. I was judgmental a lot of times. I used to enter, you know, those small, we can't really call them apartments, they're small rooms in those apartments. In each room there's a family in those, you know, buildings that are, have become sort of the shelter for these families. I used to go into a room and see kids on their own, like 3 years old, 4 years old, cold, hungry, just left alone all day long. And the first reaction that you have is be angry at the mother. I used to be very angry, like, how can she do this? How can she leave them alone? These kids die every day from neglect, you know. I was always judgmental. How can she do this? How can she leave her kids? And I would wait for the mother. I would wait for her because I want to know, who is this mother? Who is she? And I want to tell her a piece of my mind. And I used to wait for her, and she would come, and we would sit down and start talking. And 10 minutes in the conversation, all my misconceptions would, you know, completely shift. And I was every time asking myself, how can I even give myself the right to judge her? I've never been in her shoes. I've never been hungry. My kids have never been hungry. I've never had to turn my back and leave because I have no other choice because I need to work. I've never had to sell my daughter, who's 11, 12, 13 years old, to a complete stranger, thinking that maybe it's going to be good for her. Maybe she's going to go eat. And maybe because I want to feed my other kids. I've never been in her shoes. I cannot judge. So we have to understand that, you know, they're all victims. The parents are as much of a victim as the kids. And they're all part of, this vicious circle that keeps excluding them and the system that cannot find solutions for them.
It's one thing to ask professional actors and professional actors who are adults to portray a scene that is very emotionally difficult. It's another thing to ask professional actors who might be children to depict that scene. It's something entirely different to have non-professional actors who are children portray scenes of families being torn apart. How do you create a place for your actors and for your film crew where the non-professional performers can do a scene like that, that feels incredibly true, where they also know that it's make-believe, even if it's so similar to the lives that they're living?
I think what really helped me in everything in this whole adventure, it was really the fact that they felt that they were part of a mission. I mean, Zane really knows what we're talking about in the film. It's not something that I am explaining to him. Most of the time, he would explain things to me. He would say, no, that's how it's done. A 12-year-old kid who's seen so much. So for him, it's that mission that he felt he was on that gave him the strength and us the same strength to keep doing what we were doing. And we all felt part of a mission. We all felt that we had to tell this story and we have to give it everything. Outside the shoot, outside the set, and outside the script, like I told you, they are invisible. So nobody listens to them. They feel like they use words like I told you, like we're parasites, we're trash. So when they are here and they feel important, they feel like they have something to say, they feel like there's a crew fascinated by their personality, by who they are part of the mission. So it gave them wings.
Nadine, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nadine Lubbocke is the director and co-writer of Capernaum. Coming up, singer-songwriter Bea Beeman had a novel idea for his new album, Turn It Into a Podcast.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Bea Beeman is one of our favorite singer-songwriters. He has a new album titled Peace of Mind, and he came up with a great distribution idea. He's putting out each song as a separate podcast episode, mixing in interviews to explain his musical inspiration. We're happy to bring you an excerpt from his very first episode. It's for the song Brother, Can You Spare Some Peace of Mind?
Everyone asks me if Bea Beeman is my real name.
Beeman.
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 Yes, it's my given name. It's spelled B-H-I-B-H-I-M-A-N. My parents are Tamils from Sri Lanka. But I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, the birthplace of ragtime and Chuck Berry. I grew up liking all kinds of music, and if it had cool guitar in it, I was all over it. But I vividly remember listening to Bob Dylan and being struck by his political voice.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam.
And artists like the Staple Singers, Curtis Mayfield. And Peace of Mind is sort of a soundtrack to this crazy time in America. Today's song is called Brother, Can You Spare Some Peace of Mind? The theme of this episode is fear and madness. Fear is powerful, it's divisive, and it can make us do crazy things. This is something our first guest knows all too well. Glenn Washington is an incredible storyteller and the host of Snap Judgment on WNYC. I wanted to talk to Glenn because of his unique upbringing, which was definitely defined by fear and madness.
I always say I learned storytelling the old-fashioned way. I grew up in an apocalyptic, end-of-days, white supremacist Jesus cult. And it was called the Worldwide Church of God. It was founded by a guy named Herbert W. Armstrong. The basic theology is that we're living in the end times. The world's about to be tormented in a fiery cataclysm, and only those with the chosen knowledge will be spared and taken to a place of safety. And I believed storytelling is powerful stuff. That belief is a powerful thing. And I think now about how criminal it is to have that belief manipulated by charlatans. And that's what happened to me as a child. And I think what you're arguing is that's what's going on right now.
It really does feel like we're farther apart than we've ever been. And that came up again in my conversation with author and activist Dave Eggers. He's been traveling the country, interviewing people on both sides of the aisle. And he seems to agree, things have changed.
Before this, even with George W., I really thought I could totally talk all day with any Republican voter, and we could just find 92% of the common ground about basic bedrock values like, you know, honor and decency and family and all these other things. But now I can't find any common ground. I can't figure it out, because if you remove decency, honor, values, all of these things from it, I don't know what's left. The only thing that unites so much of all of his behavior is fear.
Talking with Dave and Glenn got me thinking, why is it so hard to overcome our differences? One of the foremost authorities on this subject is Stanford psychologist Lee Ross. He studies the barriers to conflict resolution and has applied his research to peace negotiations across the world.
What you can learn is to curb that first instinct and to say, let me hear a little more about what they have to say. I think there is room to do that by exposing yourself not just to issues and arguments, but exposing yourself to other people's culture, to their art, to their music, even to their cooking.
There's the famous old song from the Great Depression called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And it was about a beggar who had served his country in the war and helped build this infrastructure and felt abandoned standing in a bread line. Bing Crosby made it famous.
Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
That song is hot. That could be a hit today. But I really liked another song by James Brown off of the soundtrack to Black Caesar called Down and Out in New York City.
He said, brother, can I borrow a thin, brother, you know, a dime?
I started messing around with these guitar chords. This is one of my voice memos. And I'm a big Pink Floyd fan, so maybe in the back of my head there was a little bit of another brick in the wall going on. So I did these skits. One is a news reporter reporting from the White House.
Legal experts are saying that President Trump may possibly...
And then it becomes kind of more psychedelic as it goes on. I had all these, like, Trump-Russia titles, you know, burning a hole in my pocket.
Yes, all the hits are here. Songs like Putin on the Ritz, We Shall Overcome, WWJD, What Would Jared Do?
The song is supposed to be disorienting. It's about this crazy time that we live in. The drip, drip, drip of the Russia investigation and everything else.
Can you spare some peace of mind?
Dee Beeman's podcast, Peace of Mind, is available on all podcast platforms. And that is it for this week. I'm John Horn. Be sure to check out The Frame's Grammy special this weekend. The first broadcast is tonight at 7 p.m. here on KPCC. I'll see you back here on Monday.
Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite. Now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and best picture of the year. Now playing.